Without any further ado, I'm actually going to introduce a friend of Inforum's, Cassidy Blackwell, the head of brand at Walker & Company, who will be introducing tonight's speakers.
Thanks so much, Marissa. My name is Cassidy Blackwell, and as Marissa said, I am the head of brand at Walker & Company, the makers of Bevel, and I am so pleased to be a part of tonight's event. In my world, brand is everything, while authenticity is paramount. Both Lovey and Rochelle are masters of crafting and sharing their personal and professional brands while making a mark on their community. Lovey is a social media master who also leverages her talents to speak to social justice and issues of the day. Inforum at Commonwealth Club is also a platform for so many talented, passionate individuals to share their stories. Our CEO, Tristan Walker, was here just a few weeks ago. I'm personally so excited for tonight's conversation. Our moderator this evening, Rochelle Parham, is a leading business and marketing expert, currently serving as an advisor of Girls Who Code and on the boards of LabCorp, Scripps Network Interactive, and Drexel University. She previously held roles as Chief Marketing Officer at eBay, Head of Global Marketing and Innovation at Visa, and Head of Global Marketing Services at Visa as well. It's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Lovey Ajayi. Lovey is the author of the incredibly funny and insightful New York Times bestseller, recently bestseller, so congratulations, I'm Judging You, The Do Better Manual. She's been a blogger for more than 13 years, and her blogs, Awesomely Lovey and Awesomely Techie, draw more than 500,000 readers. She writes and speaks eloquently and hilariously on topics from social media to social justice to pop culture, everywhere from Blogger to TED to the White House. And she's the executive director of the Red Pump Project, which raises awareness of the impact of HIV and AIDS on women and girls. She will leave you crying with laughter, slay a red shoe, and teach us all just how to do a little bit better each and every day. To put it simply, and in the parlance of our times, Lovey is the GOAT, and I'm honored to welcome her here to San Francisco and Inforum tonight. Please welcome Rochelle Parham and Lovey to the stage.
Oh. So how lucky am I?
Oh my God, that was like a dope intro.
I know.
Okay. I cannot live up to the hype. Lord, lower your expectations, everybody.
So how I'm envisioning this mm-hmm. is we're just sitting in my living room.
Yes.
And we're going to have a conversation. And then there just might be people watching us.
Yes. Okay.
And listening to everything we say.
All right.
They might be live tweeting it. They might be doing whatever they need to do. But the fact is that you and I are just going to have a conversation and we'll let some folks eavesdrop.
Cool.
Does that work for you all? Yeah. All right. So I am thrilled to be here. And you all are, I know, are excited to be here too. Lovey is absolutely amazing. So she and I had our first conversation over the summer, right?
Yeah.
At the beginning of the summer,
yeah.
right before the book was coming out. And I said, I want to do whatever I can to be there for you. And there was only one stipulation. Do you remember what the stipulation was?
No.
You had to, you had to send me a book.
Oh, yeah.
You remember?
Yes. Yeah,
and then there's all the drama about how do you get the book to me and all that stuff. But mm-hmm. the fact is that's how
Because Rochelle is fancy, okay? Wow. I was like, Rochelle, how do I get this book to you? Well, I don't get home for 3 weeks. I'm at the vineyard. And I was like, oh, okay, girl.
That is true. I was
She's
on the
like,
vineyard.
I am fancy.
But
yes.
it got to me, and it was amazing. So I read my book over the summer, and now I'm sitting here chatting with you about your book.
It's kind of crazy.
This is awesome. And so here's the thing I need to understand.
Yes.
Who are you?
I thought you were going to ask me, why are you like this?
No. I'm asking that later. I'm going to ask you that later. So tell us your story. Like, where did you come from? How did you become
See, why
you
are you like this, essentially?
No. I'm going to get to the why you're like this. I promise you. Trust me. I got notes.
Okay. So my story. Yeah. I born in Nigeria. And I came to the U.S. when I was 9. Nobody told me we were coming here. I thought we were going on vacation. And then I got enrolled in school, and I was like, oh, so we're staying.
Yeah.
Nobody asked me for opinions or nothing. I am the child of proud, well-to-do people who raised me to be honest about life and who raised me to kind of walk in a room and be able to own that room.
And I was raised to not have doubt about who I am. So that's who I am. And that's who's sitting in front of you.
And so what did you want to be when you grow up? Like, so with this 9-year-old little girl who shows up and enrolled in school that she didn't know she was going to go to, like, who did you want to be? Like, what did
traitorous.
You want to do?
I wanted to be a doctor. So growing up, everybody was like, you should be a doctor, because I was somebody who was a nerd. I loved to read, and just I kept on hearing it. Like, from the time I was like 3 or 4, everyone was like, you're going to be a doctor. So I was like, I'm going to be a doctor, thinking that's what I wanted to be. And I wholeheartedly believed that I was going to be a doctor, because I'm like, yes, I'm smart. I could do that. And then I got to college. My major going in was psychology pre-med. And then my first semester of college, I took chemistry and got my first D of my academic career. And I was like, you know what? I don't even like hospitals. That's not going to work. I was like, I'll be the doctor who's like, can I not work in the hospital? So like, after that first semester, and I actually tried. So I was used to getting A's by doing zero. Like, I didn't even really try, and it just came to me. So I actually tried in chemistry, and I still got this D. And I was like, I actually went to go see my professor and went to office hours and everything. So I dropped the pre-med, and I didn't tell my mom.
Oh.
She showed up at graduation and found out I didn't drop the pre-med. That's exactly what happened. I didn't tell her I dropped the pre-med until she showed up at graduation.
It's a long time to wait.
And it was just psychology. She was like, all right, okay. And I was just like, I wonder if they're going to notice I'm not pre-med anymore. But honestly, it was, I had that come to Jesus moment with myself where I was like, okay, what do I really want to do? And the psychology I actually did want to pursue. I love psychology. So I was one of the few in my group of friends who started with one major and actually stayed within it. So I dropped the psychology, the pre-med, but I kept the psych. So I thought I was going to be doing, going to grad school and doing either industrial organizational psychology or counseling psych.
Okay.
And I actually spent 2.5 years in college as a counseling center paraprofessional. So my goal was like, go to grad school, get this like master's or PhD, and be the person helping people. As you see, that never happened.
You are helping people.
I'm helping people
every day.
Psychology didn't happen. But I just love the subject, though. So I think it's still in my spirit, maybe. I'm too ratchet to be a psychologist, though. I can't. I'll be up there giving my people side eye. You're supposed to be, like, neutral. Like, tell me more. And I'll be up there like, why are you doing that?
But I think the honesty matters, right? I mean, there's a whole bunch of folks that are feeding a bunch of crap to people.
The fact is
you could be just
be
giving
like,
people the
like,
truth.
I'd be like, go to Dr. Lovey. She's going to tell you about your life. And I'll literally be the person who's like, you should not do that. That's terrible. Yeah.
I like that. I like that. So our stories are a little similar. I wasn't supposed to be a doctor. I had never planned to be a doctor, but I always knew I was going to be a marketer. I knew that I was going to be a marketer, and I was going to be in business, and I was going to run something. I knew that was kind of what I was going to do. And so I went to school, and I was a marketing major. Like, I did it.
You know what's funny? Even though I wasn't a marketing major, I've been in marketing since sophomore year of college. I got a marketing internship, fell in love with it, and that's how I end up doing like marketing and digital communications.
It's fun.
It's so fun.
Yeah, it's the cool role.
It is.
It's the cool, sexy part of every company.
It is. You need us.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. I understand. So when did you start writing? So were you writing all along? Like, tell us about kind of the writing piece.
So writing happened because, let me see, my sophomore year, my friend was the editor-in-chief of the Daily Illini, and she was the first black editor-in-chief of the school paper ever. And somehow, I don't know how, she was just like, I just know you're a really good writer. I need you to be a columnist on the paper. And I was like, all right. Shout out to nepotism. Because she literally was like, just come write for me. And I was like, all right. So back of the paper, every Wednesday, I had a column, advice column. And people would stop me on campus and be like, I saw your advice column. That was really good. And I was like, all right. So my friends were just like, you should start a weblog. Back then, it was called weblogging. And it was 2003, and I was like, all right. So I went on Zanga. Remember Zanga? Did I just date myself? Fine. I went on Zanga. I got a blog, and I think it was called something like Consider This a Letter I Never Wrote. It was just emo and terrible. And I was writing about college life, roommate issues, exams I wasn't studying for, the D I got in chemistry. If my mom was reading my blog, she'd know I dropped pre-med. So I had this blog, and people kept on reading it. Me and my friends are full of shenanigans, and we are goofy in everything we do, so we started writing this, like, random blog posts and people started liking it. And I kept on doing it because I just liked it. And that's how blogging started for me. I deleted that blog when I graduated in 2006 and started a new blog. And I went to Blogspot and I was like, I have outgrown the college blog with Comic Sans. Let's delete that. I did. Okay, I'm a big enough person to admit my mistakes. Like,
that's awesome.
I deleted that blog and I started what? Well, it was Lovey's Random Rants was what it was first called. And that's the blog that became awesomelylovey.com. I launched it on August 8th, 2006. So my blog turned 10 years old this year.
Wow. That's awesome. So I have another coincidence.
Yes.
I wrote an advice column.
Really?
And I'm just, it's all coming to me. It's like this, I feel like you're my therapist. See, it's all working out. You're doing exactly what you're supposed
to do. Come on, spirit twin, yes.
So, in high school,
okay,
before you were even born, I wrote an advice column called Ask Twyla.
Really? Hmm? Okay, so how did that go?
So I went to a private girls' school, so okay. You can imagine our questions, you
oh,
know.
God.
So they were very, you know, there was stuff about boys, stuff about class, stuff about, you know, it was high school.
Right.
It's high school. It was in, wow. You know, nowhere near kind of where you are, and it was, you know, it was a long, 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 long time ago.
But that's interesting, though, the fact that mirrors it.
Ask Twyla.
Look at that.
See,
I was like, I think, I don't know what my column was called, but I remember I read an old thing that I wrote, and it feels very true to me today. Like, I was writing about back-to-school blues, like, I know we back from vacation, and I know we don't want to go to class, but here's why you need to go to class, because, like, your refund check won't come if you don't go. Like, I was that I was that person that was like, look, okay, go to class, all right? Don't skip discussion. You can skip the lecture, though. I was terrible. I don't even know why they give me a column.
So here's my question, then. So you are so honest
mm-hmm.
and so blunt,
mm-hmm.
and you know, tell it like it is.
Sure.
Where does that come from?
By Nigerian-ness. So Nigerians happen to be some of the least filtered people on the face of this earth. Like, we don't have behavior in couth. Because, like, growing up, so I was actually having this conversation with somebody else who's Nigerian today when I went to Google. We were talking about how we have such thick skins because we've heard worse from the people we know beyond anything anybody in a room when we walk in can tell us. So like, being like Nigerians, we don't sugarcoat much. Example. My mom, bless her heart, she is the shadiest lady on this earth, but she is so sweet that she wouldn't even, like, her shade feels like sugar until you realize it's kind of sour. So, for example, my mom walks into a room one day and sees my cousin, and she walks up to my cousin, like, and she goes, you got fat, are you pregnant? I was like, Mom, she was. Yes. But I was just like, you don't just walk up to somebody, but that's how we roll. Like, we'll be like, those shoes are terrible, you should go change that. Like, Christmas, we sit up there roasting each other all day, every day. Just being like, I walk in, like, my sister would be like, that sweater is awful. You should go change. That's terrible. And we'd be like, all right, you're right. So, for us, honesty is, like, key. And also, we don't like to, like, lie to your face. So, for me, that's how I grew up. Like, seeing people tell you how they felt in person. And you kind of took it. We're not that sensitive. Also, it's a cultural thing. Okay, communication's a cultural thing. That's also what people need to understand. And me as a Nigerian, that piece of me is still here. It's what allows me to be very blunt sometimes. When people were like, did you just tell her no? I did. But I think it's really important to, like, I think it's really important to be the person who people can understand that this is honesty. Like, yeah. They don't have to question you. They don't have to be like, is this person trying to lie to me? If I walk up to my friends and I was like, your shoes are amazing, they know it's amazing. I meant it. I'm very, like, say what you mean what you say. So, yeah, I'll say the shady Nigerian-ness.
And so have you ever written something or said something and said, oh, crap, why did I say that?
Like, yeah.
Or wish you could take it back and now you can't?
Yup.
Tell me a time when you wrote something that you were like, I cannot believe I
like,
wrote that.
Why am I so full of shenanigans all the time? So the thing about blogging for such a long time is that it chronicles my growth as a human being and as a person, as somebody who thinks critically about the world. So actively, there are things that I wrote back in the day that I vehemently disagree with now. Like, there are things that I believed and thought was my business that I wouldn't even care about today. Or points that I would make that I would be like, that's so wrong. So I've definitely become more liberal. Coming here from Nigeria, I didn't have a lot of context about race, example. So I never identified as black until I came to the U.S. because the concept of blackness was never a thing.
Yeah.
Because over there it's the default to be black. So you didn't have to define it. So I didn't even understand what black was until I came here. And even then, I didn't understand, like, you know, I didn't know the concept of slavery. I didn't know the concept of the Middle Passage. So coming here, I was like, all right, cool. There's, like, people who look like me and people who don't. When I graduated from high school, actually, my junior or senior year of high school, I did a couple of essay contests that I actually won. And I won, like, NAACP Axo Award for this essay and something else. I can't remember another. Like, I ended up winning money. And the essay was, do you think black people should get reparations? And I was like, no, you didn't work for it. And I won awards. Like, people were like, yes, great point. And I thought back, like, when I was in college, college really changed the game for me in terms of who I am today and my ideas, my politics, because that's when I was able to take black history classes. That's when I was able to be challenged in my opinion. And it also made me think about the fact that a lot of immigrants who come here come when they're older. And they don't get a chance to be in college and take history of U.S. women or race and ethnicity 101 or... I took a lot of those, and by the time I left college, I was such a different person in terms of how I thought. But then it also made me think about just the idea that, like, we are battling adults who don't get the same context. Mm-hmm. So when Africans come here, especially West Africans, who come here, were doctors back home, come here, have to start over because your degree don't count here, and you start as a cab driver, and somehow you end up as a doctor still. Why? Because you came and you carried some of that defaultness with you. You didn't come with extra burden that kind of like sat you down. Mm-hmm. So that it was definitely a huge shift in my consciousness. And then in terms of like shenanigan side, there were pieces that I wrote in like a while back. Okay, so when the whole Alicia Keys and Mashonda thing happened. I was like, Alicia, why would you break up this... What? First of all, I disagree completely with myself now. That's like...
Do you all know what she's talking about? No.
Yeah, everybody's like, y'all. But here's the thing. When I wrote that piece in, what, 2008, 2007, it went viral, and like people were like, yes, we love this piece. I think I like made it private on my site. I completely disagree with that now. It's like, here's the thing. Women always get the brunt of the blame when things like this happen. Jennifer Aniston has been getting... Angelina Jolie has been getting mad at Jennifer Aniston for 10 years, people still mad at Angelina. I'm like, Jennifer moved on. Why are you mad? Right. So, you know, things like that. For me right now, I lean towards always siding with women, no matter what it is, because the world does the opposite. So, yeah, I've changed my life, you know. I have. New person.
So I've read so many fun facts about you. One of them, and it's so interesting because I have all these people in my life that agree with something that you seem to be pretty passionate about. I have a group of...
No Spirit Airlines?
Well,
passionate.
Look at this.
I'm passionate about that. I'm sorry.
So I have three of my really close friends absolutely love Sophia Petrillo.
She's my patroness. Like... She is me.
My patroness?
She's my patroness. Y'all know Harry Potter. To fend off Dementors, you got to think about a happy memory. Sophia Petrillo's mine.
Do you all know who Sophia Petrillo is from The Golden Girls?
Yeah.
I am with my people, yes.
So talk about Sophia Petrillo. Like, what are the life lessons that she has taught you?
Sophia has taught me that, one, you can't check old people. they can say whatever they want to say, and they've been on this earth for 85 years, and you're not going to check them. She's also taught me that you can be shady to the people around you lovingly. I think that character is like what I aspire. I'm probably her like right now. She was so funny, but yeah. She also like said what you were thinking, but you were like, let me not say it.
Yes.
But then Sophia said, and you was like, I'm glad she said that. I'm essentially that person now. So yeah, that's why I love it.
So my maternal grandmother is very similar to yes. Sophia Petrillo. And so may her soul rest in peace. Some of the funniest things that I've ever heard in my life came out of her mouth. And one that, so there's some folks in the crowd who have probably heard the story a million times from me. But one of the things my grandmother said in talking about another family member and how quiet it got after she made this comment, she said, it got so quiet in there you could hear a mosquito pissing on a cotton ball.
Yes.
Well, that's quiet. That's quiet.
Yo, old people are poets.
Right, it's amazing. Amazing. Absolutely amazing.
That is like poetic. Like that is just,
and it's
I like
so
picturing
visual,
it.
Right?
And I'm just
it's
like,
visual, exactly. It's so visual. Yeah. And it's quiet. That's quiet.
My grandma was shady too. Oh, she was shady. But yeah, see, here's the thing. Also by Nigerians. And so I grew up speaking both English and Yoruba equally. And Yoruba is a very metaphorical language that allows you kind of like bend stuff and compare stuff. And Yoruba allows you to be so shady. So that also helps when I'm doing English because I kind of use some of the concepts to create these ideas. And people are like, where did you just come up with that? Okay, so once my sister, she's also shade savant. You hear me?
Savant.
Like some of the insults the Nigerians will throw at you are so creative that you're like too impressed to be mad. And you're like, dang, word, okay, I'm gonna take it. My sister called somebody, she said somebody looked like the sleeve of a shirt. And I was like, what's the logistics of that? How does that, that's just really fascinating. And then like we tend to, so first of all, my book is gonna teach people like a lot of like how to insult people. I'm really proud about that. Somebody said they read 3 chapters and already learned like 10 more insults. I was watching a video and somebody called somebody an intergalactic imbecile.
Yeah.
Like,
but
your
you know
stupidity
is
in the freaking galaxy. Wow. So, I mean, it's just impressive. We are an impressive people.
So let's talk about your book.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So you have a New York Times bestseller. Did you know you were going to have a New York Times bestseller?
I wanted to have a New York Times bestseller. Now y'all not going. I'm not gonna know how to act now. God, because you can't give me nice things. It's been a huge goal of mine. Like it's been the top thing. So anytime somebody asks me like, "What is a goal of yours?" I've been like, "I want to be a New York Times bestseller." And then it happened, like the week my book came out, and I was like, "Oh snap! It's anticlimactic because what now?"
Right.
Because well, I was like, "Now I need new goals." Oh, man. I didn't expect I was going to do it that quick.
It happened so fast.
It happened fast.
So this is the book. And my book is all raggedy now. I actually need to go buy another book and have you sign that one, too.
Yes.
And so where do we begin? So you've taught so many lessons in this book. So, right, I'm judging you, the Do Better manual. Like,
yeah,
we could do a lot better, right?
All of us.
What is the best lesson that you want every single person on this planet to know?
I would say the best lesson is you can actually commit yourself to making the world better than you found it. And that's one thing that I want people to walk away from this book holding on to. Because a lot of times I feel like we're just one person. I'm not saying everyone has to start a nonprofit organization because ain't nobody got time for that. I do apparently because I've had one for 7 years. But everybody does not have that time, and I'm not saying that's everyone's ministry, but everyone thinks if they can't do something on a grand scale, let me not do anything at all.
Yeah.
So we tend to just sit back and just be like, well, somebody else is going to do it. The reason why the world is sucky is because we thought somebody else was going to do it,
yeah.
And they didn't. So we might as well be the ones doing something. So, yeah.
So I have the same philosophy, and my words for that are, I want to know if I can touch it. If I touch it, I can make it better.
Yes.
You know, and there's so many things that we can touch and make better.
Absolutely.
And then there are so many people that we should just not touch at all.
With a 10-foot pole.
Right?
I can think of one.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about that. So we're in the middle of this incredibly heated election. You've been kind of vocal about that.
A little bit.
So one of the candidates, Hillary Clinton, said that Donald has shown us who he really is. Like, who is he to you?
He is a walking Cheeto. That is who he is. A snack that you probably should not be eating. And you're like, why is it that color? Can I just say, like, Donald Trump brings out, like, rage, like, deep rage within me. Because he is everything that is wrong with the world, one. Two, he's emblematic of everything that people hate about Americans. And three, he is walking white privilege, like white male privilege especially. So it's like this, I'm a cuss, it's this clusterfuck of, like everything that is wrong with the world, you can see it in Donald Trump. And what enrages me is not the fact that he exists. What enrages me is the fact that he's amplified and he has a platform. Like, this man should not even run a store, let alone a business, let alone a country. And then he's standing on a stage next to Hillary Clinton, who, like her or not, she spent her life in doing public service. We owe her an apology because that fool shouldn't be next to nobody, let alone her. So I'm just like, I don't know, y'all. Donald Trump is just a hot mess.
So how's it gonna end? What's gonna happen?
Listen, all right, we only have one option. And I know people are, like, heated about whether they like Hillary or not. We only have one option. Protest vote the next time. Like, I ain't got time for that shit now. And then, and, you know, people say things like, oh, him and Hillary the same. First of all, that's dumb. Just, it's not even remotely close to true. Even if she's not a perfect candidate, we're going to hold her feet to the fire because she has work to do, all right? She owes us some work. But to say they're the same person is to, like, say, like, the big bad wolf and freaking Little Red Riding Hood are the same person. Like, he's going to eat you. Like, no! So I just think it's really important, one, for us to all vote this election. Also because 88% of Congress is up for re-election. Let's sweep all them fools out. Everybody gotta go, all right? And we gonna cry when the Obamas leave office. Like, I might take a 7-day leave on my bed. I'll just, like, take to my bed for, like, a good 7 days. Like, don't come to me. You know, I will weep. And then weep, because it's been a really black White House, a really black year. And then it's not going to be black no more. And that's going to hurt. So, yeah, we have some stuff. We have some work to do, though.
So let's talk about Blackxit.
Let me pull it up.
So I probably sent that post to maybe 50 people.
Are you serious?
Honestly. Do you guys know what Blackxit is?
Down for what?
So there are people in this audience that don't know what Blackxit is. So after Brexit happened, and
also a hot mess.
Yes, absolutely. There was a lot of comments about if Trump were to go and be in office that, you know, black folks were going to leave. Like, we had to leave, and people were talking about where they were going to go. We're going to Costa Rica, but you know, a lot of folks are going to Canada. A whole lot of folks, not just black folks. Folks
Canada about to build a wall against us. Right,
exactly,
like, no, y'all can't come.
And so Lovey has this incredible post about all the stuff that folks will miss in America when all the black folks leave. And so, and here she is.
All right, so Kinfolk Collective, Salt Collective started this post on Blackxit, and then I basically took it on a whole different level. So already they said we're taking with us Beyonce, Oprah, Shonda, We're taking soul food. So then my audience, because Love Nation is the most turnt, decided to add to it. And so far we have jazz music, Little Richard, Dave Chappelle, y'all, I don't know, Sam Jackson, because he's the blackest person on the face of this earth. Somebody said they were taking seasoning, okay? We are, of course, taking Mother Cicely Tyson with us. Yes, Mother Cicely, she's gonna like rule over Blacksit. And then I insist that we're taking the butters with a Shea and Coco.
The Obamas, absolutely.
Oh, the Obamas, for sure. That's like, yeah. They're like running the ship, all right? We're going to have to take peanut butter. Okay, Denzel Washington, Idris Elba. Because we're going to have to recreate an amazing community. Somebody said we're taking edges. Yo. Somebody said y'all can keep Lauryn Hill. That hurt, right? That hurt. And then it got really real, because then people started talking about what we're taking with us, because black people invented it. So we're taking like traffic lights. We are taking the heart defibrillator.
Yeah.
We're taking computers and cell phones.
Vaccines, right? We got some vaccines in
there. Oh yeah, some vaccines gotta come with all the hella cells coming with us. So all the cancer things coming with us too. So then my white readers decided that they needed to negotiate with us some terms. So they said somebody said, oh my God, I think us white people are down to dried peas and smallpox. Somebody was like, okay, so the coalition is going to offer some specials on the 5-day work week and brisket. And then somebody was like, okay, we will give you Jesus, we want Sammy Davis Jr. And then the Asian said, we'll take the noodles and the spaghetti and the ramen and the linguine. So it became a whole thing. And then the Asians also said they're taking chopsticks. So like white folks ain't gonna have nothing to eat with. And oh, also Asians are taking threading. So y'all eyebrows gonna be jacked. Uh-huh. And my girl Rachel said, all we have left is NASCAR boiled meats and Conan O'Brien. And mayonnaise. Y'all can keep, but we need that for the potato salad though.
Yeah.
So we might have to take mayonnaise because we need it for the potato salad for the picnics, and that's important. And we're also taking the good greens. We're going to leave kale behind.
Yup. So what I read that and honestly sent it to 50 people.
Blackson was lit, yo. Like.
So there's something that you say, which I think is incredibly powerful, and it is stand in your worth.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
So stand in your worth, stand in your power, because especially women and especially women of color, we're not taught to stand in our worth. We're taught to negotiate everything down as opposed to up. So we walk in a room and people are like, oh, how much is your price for this? And you say it and they want to negotiate you down, and you're told that you have no room to negotiate, that they might say no, so you don't. And for me, it's really important, especially as a woman who runs her own business. And writers don't think of ourselves as businesses sometimes, but we are. Stand in your worth and say no. So last year was my year of yes. This year is my year of no. And no is a powerful thing, because when you are able to walk away, you have the upper hand. So being able to be like, you know what? You can't afford me right now. I respect it. I respect it. Holler at me later, all right? And it's really hard to walk away from money on the table, because you're like, if I walk away from this, I need this money. But here's the thing is, if you accept that, you're going to keep getting that. And so here's the thing. Nicki Minaj, I don't like her music. But Nicki, as a feminist, as a woman who like owns her own power, I respect her so hard. And she told this story, and I use it now, no more pickle juice. she showed up at a photo shoot, and they had like three things on the rack for her. And catering had pickle juice and like a jar of pickles, not even like real food. So she looked around, she's like, no. And she walked away. And her agent was like, Nikki, you can't walk away. Like, we're supposed to do this shoot. She was like, here's the thing. They just gave me pickle juice. If I keep accepting pickle juice, they're going to keep giving me pickle juice. So I'm saying no to pickle juice. And she walked out. And I was like, yes, we got to start saying no to pickle juice and stop accepting pickle juice in our lives, in our personal lives, in our business lives. It's important to tell people exactly how you want them to treat you. So that comes in standing your worth and being like, no, I won't accept it. And then how they take it is none of your business after that.
Yeah.
If they understand your value, they'll come back when they have enough money for you. If they don't come back, well, go get somebody who does understand and can pay you. And that's fine.
And you interviewed Oprah?
I did interview Mother Oprah. Oh, man. That was a moment. That happened by happenstance. I call myself Forrest Gump. Because you know how Forrest Gump end up in all the rooms? And you're just like, oh, okay. I'm like the Forrest Gump of blogging. So this year, Oprah did a Super Soul 100 list. It's her first list that she's done. And she picked 100 people. She handpicked 100 people who she thinks are elevating humanity. And the Super Soul 100 list is split into five categories. Entrepreneurs, entertainers, givers, igniters, and teachers. So I fall under the entertainment. And I like asked the person that owned, I was like, wait, Oprah picked me? Like, she knows who I am. She like had to pick every person on the list. So she had this brunch in April where when Oprah tells you to come to LA and have brunch, you go. she had a brunch for the Super Soul 100. And it's this list has like Ava DuVernay on it, Deepak Chopra. It has like Arianna Huffington. It's like this amazing list. So to even be on it, it's just like, what? So somehow 70 of this 100 end up in a room together. NJRE, Jesse Williams, God, he's bae. Can I just tell you, he's not fair. Like, the guy you see on camera, when you see him in person, he's even more attractive. And then he has the nerve to be funny. And then he's not too short.
And he's very passionate, too.
And looking at him, I'm just like, don't get lost in his eyes. And he's super smart. Anyway, so at this brunch...
What happened was...
So at this brunch, we got to do a photo shoot with Oprah. Well, so the OWN team is like, oh, my God, we, like, love working with you. You're amazing. I was like, oh, my God, y'all actually know who I am. So they invited me to come back to L.A. in June. And they wanted me to interview the cast of Greenleaf. Greenleaf is one of the newest shows on OWN. And Oprah plays, like, the shady auntie. So they were like, oh, you're going to interview the cast of Greenleaf for OWN, and it's going to be live streamed on, like, Facebook and all that stuff. And I was like, oh, cool. So I'm assuming it's the cast, not Oprah. Like, not counting Oprah, because you should say you're going to interview Oprah and the cast of Greenleaf. The day of, they were like, oh, yeah, surprise, you're interviewing Oprah. I said, like, in real life. So after the screening happens, I'm sitting there holding the OWN mic. They've mic'd me up and everything, and Oprah comes. And it's actually, like, sitting right here, so even closer than you are. She's like, hey, lovey. Girl! Stop! So I was supposed to interview her 5 minutes, end up being 10 minutes. And, like, during the interview, I was talking about, like, her character's hair in that show. It's, like, Epic Afro. And she was like, you know, hair is a big deal. I was like, I know, I just cut mine because I had mid-back locks up until April. And she was like, really? And then she turned to me and became the interview and was like, Lovey, what's going on with you? I was like, girl, let me tell you, Oprah. I was like, you know, I feel like I'm going to a new way. Like, I'm getting a new book. And she's like, oh. And then she, like, grabs my head. Chat, anointing, okay? I was like, I receive it. And then after we finished the interview, she gives me this hug. And, like, when Oprah hugs you, it feels like clouds and, like, dreams realized and money. Just... And then, like, there's a picture of her stroking my head some more. and both of us cackling, okay? So that was my moment when I was like, I've been anointed by Oprah. I can die now. So it was amazing. It was amazing.
So I met Oprah, I guess about 2 years ago, and it's like magic. It's like magic.
No.
And I just wanted her to be okay. Like, everyone takes so much energy
from her,
and I just wanted to give her energy. I just wanted, and I kept thinking, afterward, I was like, what was I doing? I should have just taken all the energy everybody else was taking from her.
But you know what?
But I was like, here, Oprah, take my energy, take my energy.
There's something very common about her.
She's amazing.
So when people, like, did you fangirl? There's something about her that keeps you from fangirling. She has this very calming spirit.
Yeah.
And I also think it's the way she carries herself in general. Like, there's people who are rich who carry themselves horribly. When you see them, you just feel the anxious energy. They're not comfortable in their own skin.
Yeah.
And then it kind of puts you off ease. And I've met a billionaire who's that person. Then I'm just like, whew, there's a lot of anxiety there.
Yeah.
Oprah is like, she walks in, and you're just like, I feel your center.
Right.
Yes, I don't even talk like this. I just,
exactly.
So grounded. Like, she like,
and it's a hug. It's a hug.
And she just like, she hugs you with her whole like being, which.
And it's sincere. It's very
It's
sincere.
A testament to her spirit too, because to be Oprah has got to be very difficult.
Yeah.
Because people see her and they don't let her leave. And at Essence Fest in July, they did the Queen Sugar screening there, and they did a cocktail party. Now, the cocktail party was invite only. So own handpicked people who were going to be there, like 100 people. Celebrities are here, like people who are influential. At the party, Oprah could not leave.
Yeah.
Because as she's about to walk out, people swarmed her. And these are people who are notable. And they did that to her.
Right.
And I was just like, can you imagine her day to day of having to function? And when like people who are rich and famous themselves freak out and don't let you move. She was trying to move. And her team, of course, was trying to be the bad cop. And people were like, will step in front of her. Like, this is Oprah. Somebody would stop right here and be like, oh my God, I love you so much. And I was like freaking out on her behalf. Like,
right.
I can't.
That's what happens.
That can turn you into an introvert.
Right.
Yeah. Like, I was just like sitting back, like, that dad didn't try to make any contact with her.
Yeah.
Because I was like, it's too much around her all the time.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. She's amazing. She's a unicorn.
So let's talk about pop culture for a minute.
Yes.
I'm going to give you a category, and you can pick where you want to go.
Okay.
We can either do movies, we can do TV, or we can do music.
TV.
All right. Let's do TV, and tell us what you think. What's about to happen? Give us some wisdom.
We are in the second golden age of television right now. Yeah. I firmly believe that, because TV's killing the game.
Yeah.
Right now, no matter what type of content you're into, you can find a really good TV show. Like... And then I also love the fact that black women are running so much of television. Like, we have Courtney Kemp running Power on Stars. We have Shonda running ABC.
Right.
Like, I ain't got to talk about Thursday only. No, like, just give her all of ABC. And the fact that actually the president of ABC is a black woman. The black woman takeover is happening. It's a beautiful thing to see, because here's the thing. For such a long time, we were locked out of it. And then... Shonda came, changed the game, and was able to show that, look, here's this really black, this is a show led by a black woman, Scandal, and it killed ratings so hard that finally somebody else at a different network was like, let's do this here.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I'm a huge fan of everything that's happened. Netflix is killing. Yeah. Netflix also changed the game, and here's where competition comes in handy. Netflix, House of Cards changed everything.
Yeah.
You know, because House of Cards is what made the Emmys? Emmys,
yeah.
Change the categories, like, and create a category, because they were like, we can't ignore this really good show. Game of Thrones is killing. So right now, Blackish is one of the funniest television shows on. And I think Hollywood needs to recognize, one, this is not a trend. Like, we're not just hot right now. We're hot in general. So we need access into these rooms, and you need to let us tell our stories. So... I'm excited. I am hoping we shall see.
Mm.
Maybe TV's next for me.
What?
But let the record show, I am not an actress. I can only play Lovey. So I don't want to necessarily be in front of the cameras, but I would love to write for television.
Really?
I think I could.
Oh, you absolutely could. You absolutely could.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
That would be cool. I actually have to find an agent, apparently. See, I just want to write. Meanwhile, I got to find an agent.
You have a lot of stuff to do.
I do. It's overwhelming. But apparently, like, getting an agent is the first thing. But I'm kind of like, okay, we'll see what happens. We'll see.
So when you look at the next, let's say 18 months. I don't want to restrict you to 12. I don't want to get you to 24. Let's say 18 months. Like, what are all the things you want to do?
Run the world. No, I'll be a terrible ruler. Because I'm too petty. I hold grudges. That's my superpower. I'd be like, oh, that person, I ain't like them. She can't work in my, no. I think, you know what? I hadn't thought past what I wanted to do after this book. I really hadn't. Like, the book was like my stop. I was so hyper-focused on making the book happen. I didn't look beyond it. Yeah. So when people ask me now, I was like, I guess TV. I guess maybe write a second book in the next 18 months.
Wow.
Maybe I'm still judging you. I don't know. Was judging you 2.0. I actually would like to try my hand writing for a TV show. My book is getting some interest, so we shall see. But
awesome.
I'm open to seeing what the universe drops at my feet, because honestly, my career has been a testament in that. None of this was strategy. None of this was like me 5 years ago being like, okay, and then I'm going to write a book, and then I'm going to do this. No, I've always just done what was right at the moment, what felt right at the moment, what I enjoy doing. And doors opened and things happened. So I figured that's worked so far, so I might just keep that going. But I also want to speak on more world stages and tell white people to do better on grander stages. That has been what I've been doing the last 2 weeks, to be really honest. Using my voice to continue to make some like real change is something that I want to do always, actually. So not just in the next 18 months.
So what's a day with Lovie like?
It depends. If I'm home or traveling. If I am home, I'm in my pajamas to like a good 4 p.m. And that is real, okay? I wake up around 9 o'clock. You know, a lot of people talk about, oh, my God, I wake up and pray, I meditate, I exercise. I find my center. No, I get on Facebook. I get on Facebook and Twitter and check emails. I do a lot of conference calls back to back, because the days when I'm home are the days I can actually do work. The days when I'm traveling all over the place and doing random things and being Forrest Gump, I'm not doing work. Well, sometimes I am. So I do cherish the stillness that happens when I'm home. Mm-hmm. Even though I bought a memory foam mattress. It doesn't know me. It's like I have no memory of who you are. It has not learned me at all. If I'm traveling, odds are I usually get on a 6 a.m. flight, which, why? Why do I do that to myself? Why I do that to myself? Because I actually want to spend an extra night in my bed, even if it's 2 hours.
Yeah.
So I usually get on a 6 a.m. flight. I get off the flight and go straight to something, an event. I'm always like on the go, and then I crash at the end of the night. I like get to my hotel and I just shut up for 3 hours. And the crash is real. But I sleep on every flight. I'm the person who's like asleep before the flight even takes off. And everybody was like, what? How? And then I wake up when it lands, like, oh, great, I'm here. Yeah, I'm that person. Yeah.
So tell us about the Red Pump Project.
Yes. So, as if I wasn't doing enough. When I was in college, when I was a counseling standard professional, I had an extra semester to do whatever I felt like doing, because I'd already hit all my credits and done all the work. So I was like, ooh, I should do a show about an illness that's like affecting the world. So I started doing research, and then I started seeing HIV and AIDS stats and the fact that something like 40 million people had died around the globe. So then I started putting on the show, and in the process I met somebody who had 20 cousins who were orphaned in Malawi, and they were all living with their grandmother. Like, their parents died of AIDS-related complications. And for me, I was like, I didn't know this was still a thing. I thought it was handled, because I didn't hear about it anymore. And since then, it had been something in my consciousness. So in 2009, I was having a conversation with one of my friends, and I was like, I want to do something around HIV and AIDS and red shoes, because I figured that that would get people's attention. And she was like, you know what? One of my friends just found out that he's HIV positive. And his brother's HIV positive, and their mom is having a hard time with dealing with the fact that two of her sons are living with this epidemic. So we wanted to do something around women because we know women are the caretakers. We bear the brunt of everything. And we live in silence while doing it. So that's how we started the Red Pump Project. We got bloggers to talk about it on March 10th, which is National Women and Girls HIV and AIDS Awareness Day. We were like, no matter what it is you typically talk about, on this day, here's some stats, wear some red shoes, and tell people why this is still an issue. And 135 bloggers end up doing it, which blew our minds, because we sent it to like 20. And so Red Pump became a national nonprofit organization. We have teams in 4 different cities and states, and we do workshops around HIV and AIDS and empowerment. Because, you know, Chimamanda Adichie, who's my favorite writer, she said, we teach girls shame. And it's something that Red Pump wants women to unlearn, that shame that comes with being sexual creatures. Like, you want us to be freaking the sheets but have no experience. How? Like, we can't be Blanche if we're virgins. Mm-hmm. And so our whole thing is like, okay, if you're going to have sex, here's some condoms. Here's how you're going to be safe. And if you are living with this epidemic, you're not like a leper. Like, there's nothing wrong with you as a person. So our whole goal is like decrease stigma, talk about this kind of thing on Twitter. If you can talk about it on Twitter, you can talk about it to your partner. And, you know, give people options. So we've worked with like the U.S. Embassy. We went to Haiti last year and did workshops for 900 people in a week. And gave out 6,000 condoms. So, yeah, that's Red Pump.
That's amazing. So we're going to also start lining up for questions. And we're going to line up over here for questions. So if you have a question, please hop in line. So I have another question for you before we take some questions from the audience. What's your favorite thing to write about? Like, what gets you excited and gives you energy and gives you life? What are those things that you enjoy, really enjoy writing about?
Shenanigans. I really just enjoy writing about a lot of stuff, because if I was writing about just one thing, I would have quit writing by now because I'd be bored. I enjoy being able to like hit a point where somebody's like, I didn't think about it like that. Mm. And that happens probably more than I know, because I get some notes when it happens sometimes. Being able to hear from somebody that like my content somehow changed them in a way. So like yesterday I was in Seattle, somebody came up to me and said she didn't plan on coming because she was having the roughest year of her life. And she was like, I don't feel like going, but my friend forced me to come. And she's like, this night and some of your content has been the reason why I've smiled in some of my darkest hours. Wow. And I get those things, and I'm just like, yes, I will keep on talking about shenanigans and Blacksit. Let's keep that going. So, yeah, like things that make people really kind of escape from the terribleness of the world. And then I talk about the terribleness of the world. But sometimes in between it, you laugh, even as you're reading about the terribleness of the world. So,
well, you're funny, you know, so it helps.
I am a fool, yes.
Should we go to questions?
Fool or enthusiast? Wait, where are people?
Is it on? Is that on yet? Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello. Welcome. Thank you for coming. My name is Tiffany Black. And so my question is, where can I, my friends, and everybody else in this room get judgy pops? You need to put them on your site, like the big giant ones, like make a big giant one and just have it so like we could buy it for our friends, full size judgy pops. Just staring at you.
So here's the thing. Judgy Pop is expensive. Okay, so Judgy Pop, which is the actual lollipop that's on the cover. It's an actual lollipop, strawberry flavored.
And you have one on you.
And I have a lapel of it, but I'll tell you about that one later. So the actual sucker, I should have had it here, but I'm low. I need to reorder Judgy Pop. To have to sell Judgy Pop, I feel like Judgy Pop needs to be one of those special items that if you have it, you either saw me in person or I sent it to you. Yeah. So I don't want Judgy Pop to be like available for mass consumption. But, so the form that you can get Judgy Pop and mass consumption is the pin. The pin that I'm wearing is on Pin Vibes LA. You can also go to imjudgingyoubook.com. It'll give you a link to it. So you can buy a pin of the Judgy Pop and wear it on you. I don't know. I want Judgy Pop to be highly exclusive, you know? Judgy Pop is a highfalutin broad, okay? Highly exclusive, okay?
Hi, everyone. So my name is Dafra. Hi, Lovey. I've been following you for years. Hey, I'm so excited to be here. First of all, congratulations. I am so happy for your success. Like, I feel like I'm sitting over there. I'm so happy. Congratulations. It's amazing. It's just amazing to see all of these things come to life. And yeah, I just wanted to say I'm super proud of you. And the second thing, and you know, where my question is going to come from, is that I'm an immigrant and I was born in Western Africa and I came here 11 years ago. And there's one piece that you wrote a few years ago about the difference, you know, and how Africans, people from African descent related to African Americans. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the deepest pieces I've ever had the chance to learn, and something that really embodied you know, some of the, I would say, the differences in thinking and so on. So is that something that you plan on talking a little more about? Or I would really love you to explore that topic a little more.
So I wrote this piece talking about really essentially what I was talking about earlier. Because on Twitter, somebody tweeted me and said, hey, Lovey, is the word Akata derogatory? And I couldn't just answer the question and say yes and walk away. So Akata is a word that is used by West Africans to talk about African Americans. So now, a lot of people don't realize it's derogatory because they just think it's the word for African American. But the etymology of it, it basically means like a bush animal. So what happens is people come here, hear their parents referring to African Americans as Akata, so they just think it's just a word. They don't realize what comes with that word. So I end up describing like how that is very, it shows how people don't understand sometimes the way they are actually oppressive, and they just think it's just life. And I talked about how as African Americans, well, I'm also like both, because at this point I identify as African American, because born there, but my formative years are here. And that word shows the stereotypes that some Africans hold about Black Americans. And it comes down to also not knowing the context of slavery and the Middle Passage and knowing where African Americans are coming from in terms of the history and the oppression they've had to deal with and the denigration. So that piece actually ended up everywhere for a bit. And people read it and was like, I didn't even think about this. And people who were even my age who were Africans were like, I never knew about this word meant this. I just thought it just meant any other word. But I'm down to talk about it whenever people want to talk about it. I'm down to hold a discussion about it in person because I do think bridges need to be built between Black people in the diaspora, even West Indians, West Africans, Black Americans. There's too much divide there. And it's because people are not having these real conversations. And, you know, also those of us who are Africans and can hear our parents say it, it's our job to be like, yo, that's not cool. Like, don't use that word in my presence. Don't even use that word. And especially not when I'm here. Like, that's not okay. And even that matters. Like, I've told my mom that. Because even she didn't necessarily know like what Akata really meant. Because it's so ingrained into how people refer to Black Americans when they're African that most people don't even think about what it really, really meant. Yeah.
Hi, Lovey.
Excuse my voice. I'm Katrina Carter, and I'm so unbelievably excited you're here. Two things. One, I wanted to thank you. I actually had to buy the audio version of your book in addition to a hard copy, and I listened to it in my car all the time, and recently went through a divorce, and literally, you make me laugh so much. Like anytime I am feeling down, I'm constantly like, oh, I just need to turn on Lovey. Lovey will just bring me out of this right now. So I wanted to ask you, and I think I use unable to can probably about 15 times a day. I wanted to know how you decided to use teasing the trap in order to sell your goods, and how do you decide? You have so many different Loveyisms that you could put on there. How do you decide which ones to turn into an actual purchase good and not?
So before I partnered with Teasing the Trap, I was with Teespring. You're doing one of those campaigns. And I mean, I was making money from it. But then for me, I wanted to support a Black business and be like, what can a Black business do with me that can bring us both money? And Teasing the Trap, Arsha Jones, who's behind it, she's such a dope person. Like, super nice. Her work is good. Her background is graphic design. So when she started Teasing the Trap and she was doing these dope shirts, I was paying attention. I was buying some of the shirts. And then I was like, one day I hit her up and I was like, yo, we should do these t-shirts together. And she was like, yeah. She quit her full-time job once Teasing the Trap started because it took off so much. So that has been a great partnership. So anytime you buy one of my t-shirts, you're supporting two black business owners, two black women. T-shirts, mugs. I got magnets now, too, that has Black History Year on it. And then what was the other question? Because I have no memory.
How do you decide what to turn to a product?
So right now, the t-shirts that I have on sale are Unable to Can, which is like the most popular t-shirt. It's the one that still sells above all else. I have Giver of No Dams. I have a fist up one, because I feel like sometimes you got to rock your fist up. I got the Black History Year. I try to figure out what I want to wear. So like every shirt that you see of mine or any product that you see with my name on it is things that I would wear. So I basically just have an excuse to like buy my own stuff. Yeah. That's essentially it. So sometimes we'll add more. We'll take some. There's onesies that say Unable to Can, so your babies can be wearing Unable to Can t-shirts. So that's cool too. So yeah. Well, I'll add more, take out some stuff, but I think Unable to Can is going to stay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, Lovey.
Hi.
So I have like three of your books because I forgot I ordered it first, and then I ordered another one, and then I got one tonight, and then I got the audiobook. But I'm a fan. So what I wanted to ask is, I am actually working on my doctorate in education, and what I'm actually working on is the impact of racial identity development on Black students in college. Mm. So when you talk about your experience in college, I know you've covered this, but I kind of wanted to know, can you talk a little bit about more about how your identity developed in college? Like, were there stages? I don't know if you've heard of Dr. Cross. He's from Chicago, Dr. William Cross. He's talked about the stages that, you know, students go through as they're developing their identity. And a lot of that happens in college.
Right. It actually is true. Because when I started college, I was still in the point where my Africanness was not something I embraced because it othered me. First of all, I lost my accent by mimicking my classmates. So by high school, I had lost most of my accent. I can actually fit in on day one. And I used to go up to my teachers on day one before class started to be like, hey, don't call my name when you get to roster. Because they get to Ifeoluwa and they're like, what? This name is hard. And automatically I have to put my hand up and be like, that's me. You can call me Lovey. Like, you can call me Lavette. And so for a bit there, I didn't like the fact that my last name, I was number one on the list all the time because Ajayi is my last name. So off jump, I would start first day of school as the girl who has a different name. And then when I got to college, I saw other African people, and West Africans, Ethiopians, Ghanaians, Nigerians, like Somalians, holding on to their culture. And here I am actively trying to hide it. By like junior year of high school, of college, I was like VP of the African Cultural Association, super African, just out here. Out here, like, yes. But that was one thing I embraced. And then two, one of the classes that really made the most impact on me was I think it was sophomore year or junior year, I took a class called Black Women in the U.S. And my professor, Dr. Millward, who I'm still really cool with, she's a mentor of mine. On day one, she looks like very ethnically ambiguous. She could pass for really whatever she wants based on whatever tan she has or her hair. So on day one, she gets up in front of the class and she goes, I know y'all probably wonder why this white woman is teaching your class, but I'm black. Oh, and by the way, on Valentine's Day, we're having a test because I'm single, so I don't care. I was like, I was like, I'm going to love this class. So first day of school, I was in the back of the class. By the second day, I was in row two, like, hey. And me and her used to banter back and forth in the middle of class because as I challenged some of her ideas, but she taught me, my ideas of who I was in the beginning of that semester, by the end of it, it was completely different. Like, I had really explored the role of black women in the U.S. and how we've evolved and how we've stood strong in the face of all these awful things being thrown at us. So that was probably, and then that semester, I also took two other Afro classes. I took a race and ethnicity class, and I took one class that was a fishbowl that was like 10 black people in this class and 10 white people. And every class where we going at it. Okay, and one time they made us do a fishbowl exercise. Anyone here ever done one of those? So a fishbowl, one inner group will sit on the inside, they sit on the outside, and you just talk, and they have to sit there and listen. They cannot interrupt you. And you switch, they do the same, and then y'all come together and battle it. When I heard people being like, white people, the white students were like, you guys take all the scholarships. Everybody was like, wait a minute. Our teacher was like, you can't interrupt. So that semester, I took three very, like, deep race classes, and it certainly changed me. It changed me, and that was like, I feel like everybody should take those classes in those environments because it changes your life. Yeah.
So we have time for one more question.
Okay. Man, this is fun as heck.
I know, right? We don't have
come
to
on,
leave.
Come on, Sam. Right. They're going to be like, Lovey, you have to leave the stage. I'm like, but me and Rochelle aren't done. Hey, girl.
So I hope this doesn't throw you a curveball, but it's kind of like a funny slash but serious question. So you mentioned a little earlier, at the beginning of the year, you started this blackest year ever. Mm-hmm. And like we've got the months, like we've just carried Black History Month right on through all of 2016.
Yeah.
At the same time, there's been a lot that's happened in 2016 that has caused a lot of sorrow in our community. How do you balance celebrating the blackest year ever, all the accomplishments we've made, but all of the negative and all of the murders and all of the the racial discriminations and everything else that's come along with it? How do you balance that content with your followers? How do you deal with it yourself? Just kind of enlighten us on that.
I feel like celebrating blackness, even in the face of tragedy, is revolutionary, and it's necessary, right? I also feel like white people are freaking the hell out.
Yeah.
This year has been both awful and amazing at the same time.
Yeah.
And that dichotomy is hard to reconcile, but I've made a point to push through the sad and the awful because it's what keeps my head above water. It's what tells me that, you know what, black people have been through worse and we keep on standing. We bend, but we don't break. And it is just a reminder that every single day being black is a struggle and you being able to get out of bed is amazing. So we gotta keep cheering ourselves on. It is one of those things that's like, as they kill us in these streets, we're in the White House also. It's this weird dichotomy of like, every time we have something to celebrate, something horrible happens.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's meant to break us, but we can't let it. Like, we just can't afford to be broken in these moments. So I take it a point of myself to sometimes be the voice that's like, you know what? This awful stuff happened. We are constantly being beaten down, but we can also laugh in the face of that. You know, I feel like that has kept black people through slavery. You watch certain things and you wonder how people used to sing in 1850, how they used to find moments of joy and laughter. It's like, that is just amazing that in the worst condition of humanhood, people still manage to find pieces and slices of joy. And I want to keep that going. I want us to make sure we never lose our joy because that has always kept us going.
Wow.
Thank you.
So because I'm on stage with you, I actually get to ask you the last question.
Ooh.
So Inforum has a tradition.
Yes.
And they ask all of their speakers this. And now I get to ask you, what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
I have many ideas. Let me give you some in 60 seconds. One, we destroy Spirit Airlines. I think that's important, okay? Two, I am taking a personal mission of myself. My life is not complete until Spirit Airlines leaves. I think we can change the world by making sure that every kid gets to go to school. And we take it for granted here that, like, we don't even want to go to school because it's, like, 20 degrees outside. We're like, Mom, no. But they're, like, places where the 70% literacy rate, and people never get to get transformed to the world because they can't read. You know, even the worst of conditions, being able to escape in a moment because you read something, you're in a different world, can be something that changes your life. So I don't know how we can make that happen, but I do think we need to make it a priority, especially girls, you know. Yeah. In societies where literacy rates are low, girls is like non-existent. Because we're the ones who, if you have to pick between the boy and the girl, they go with the boy because he can run a business. Meanwhile, we're the bosses, like natural bosses. So I do think that's important. And also, let's destroy Spirit Airlines. That's important. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've had a lot of fun. This has been incredible. Could you all please give Lovely just another round of applause?
No, no, do not do standing ovation. No.
Oh my God.
And wait, time out. Okay. No! So, you guys, I'm trying to say something here, guys. Okay? So I have to say that the success of my book, of this massive tour that you're seeing, of the fact that, like, I'm in 18 places at the same time, one has been driven by powerful women who stood behind me and beside me. This entire process of this book, from the time when I got my deal, from me writing it, from me wanting to market it, and things that I've said I needed to do to make this book a success, women have been the ones who've been like, we got you.
Love so. You.
So I just, first of all, there's a couple of people in here that I need to thank, and one of them is going to fight me after this because I'm doing it. Lisa Stone. Like, Lisa has basically been like fairy godmother, and a lot of what I'm doing in SF is because of her. And then Lisa makes this amazing connection, and now I have my newest mentor, Rochelle. Okay. And I asked her to do this thing with me, and she said yes, and I sent her all caps. Oh my God, woot! An email.
That is true.
And then, like, Cassidy from Bevel and Walker and Co., who, like, introduced. And Marissa from Commonwealth Club. And Kim from Commonwealth Club. And then beyond the people who are in this room, I am up here and this book ended up on this list because there are some women who were like, you are not going to fail and we're not going to let you fail. So for those who are not here, for those who I didn't name, for those who blurred my book, y'all who constantly pub my book and tell people, oh, you don't have a copy yet, you need one because you're not cool if you don't got one. So I just have to say thank you to this community, my community at large. I don't take any of it for granted. And one of the things I always say is, like, I bring you into rooms with me. Whenever I'm doing interviews, I give Love Nation a shout out. Like, whenever I'm talking to a brand and they're like, we want to work with you, I'm like, how's my audience going to like it? So I just wanted to let you know I don't take it for granted. And I just thank you all. And let's do some dope stuff together and dominate the world. Thank you.